This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. Horror movies have kept alive the fear of vampires, the undead which rise at night to stalk the living and feed on their blood. Tales of vampires exist in the folklore of many cultures. My guest Raymond McNally has studied vampires, as portrayed in folklore, literature, and film. His books include In Search of Dracula, which was written after he discovered the original Castle Dracula while traveling through Transylvania in 1967 on a Fulbright research grant. McNally is a professor of Romanian and Eastern European history at Boston College. In his research, McNally discovered that Bram Stoker named the vampire in his classic novel Dracula after the 15th century Romanian prince Vlad Dracula. The prince wasn't a vampire, but he terrorized his subjects by punishing transgressors with impalement on wooden stakes, which is why he was also known as Vlad the Impaler. Raymond McNally told me more about Vlad's cruel and sadistic reign.
Well, he lived from 1431 to 1476, and the time period was when the Turks were moving up through the Balkans, a very turbulent period. And it was a very cruel period, too, in which he lived. As a child, he was given as a hostage to the Turks by his own father on the promise that the father, who was named Dracul, would not go to war with the Turks. And what did the father do? Father turned right around and went to war with the Turks while his own son was held there hostage. Now, my assumption on that is, look, if I was left by my own father among these Turks as a hostage, and I hear my dear old dad has gone to war violating the treaty, thereby putting my life in jeopardy, I think life is pretty cheap as a teenager if that's the way your own father treats you. So it was a rough time. Then when he came to the throne, his brother had been buried alive by the gentry, the boyars, and his father had been assassinated. It's a rough time. So it's no wonder he took vengeance initially, but then he pushed it far beyond that. He was, frankly, a sadistic kind of cruel person.
Can you describe a little bit the torture that he became known for?
Well, impaling is, of course, a lost art, fortunately, for most of us. The classic way of impaling is to take the victim, tie one horse to one leg, one horse to the other leg. The victim is on the ground. Take a stake or pole, oiled, rounded at the end. That's important so it won't pierce your innards. It's inserted in you. Slowly the horses move forward and you're hoisted up on it and you die slowly from exposure to the elements. Very cruel way and slow way to die.
Okay, this Vlad the Impaler, also known as Dracula, was terribly sadistic, but he wasn't a vampire.
No, he wasn't. His story, you know, he was a horror figure, basically. Real horror. And his story was very, very popular in the late 15th century in Leningrad. And I looked at this manuscript which talks about him in Russia. This manuscript was made in several copies. It's well known. And then there were some German stories about him in manuscript written by monks and also pamphlets. So his reputation spread around a great deal as a horror figure, as someone who was cruel. They often added this business of cruel but just, given the time period. Tough time period, he took extreme measures. I don't agree with that, but that's the explanation that's usually given.
How do you think the Bram Stoker novel connected to Dracula? Because there's a whole other body of vampire folklore which we'll talk about.
Yeah.
But Bram Stoker used the name of Dracula, who you've researched, and he wasn't a vampire.
No, that's correct. What happened is Bram Stoker was impressed with a story called Carmilla, written by another Irish author, Sheridan Le Fanu, which is a very bizarre story, actually, for that period, the Victorian period. It's a vampire story with kind of quasi-lesbian overtones, undertones, and things like that. Anyway, that story impressed Bram Stoker. He wanted to write a vampire story himself. He wasn't sure where he was going to set it, and I know from the notes, which I discovered in Philadelphia at the Rosenbach Foundation, Stoker's own diaries and journals, that he thought of putting it in Styria, which is where this Carmilla story is, part of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. And then he changed his mind when he got to reading a book. He was at Whitby, and I know this again from his notes, at Whitby Public Library. He took out this book by a fellow named Wilkinson, who was a former consul in Bucharest, British consul. He talked, this Wilkinson, in the book about a fellow named Dracula, who was clever, crafty, and all that sort of thing. So there were a couple of lines that fought against the Turks and all that. So Stoker literally took these lines, lock, stock, and barrel, from this book, and took the name then, and threw that in. Then, in a book by Emily Gerard, he came across the whole chapter on Transylvanian superstitions, and there he found all the material for his vampire folklore, which is all authentic Transylvanian folklore. He did not make up anything. Garlic, all that business, is the stake through the heart, he took that in. So he incorporated that. So often, and then he came across the legend of the Blood Countess, this Elizabeth Báthory. You remember in the novel, which you don't see in the movies, when Count Dracula first appears, he has a white mustache and white hair. He's an old man in the novel, unlike Frank Langella or Christopher Lee. They all look young. No. And then as he gets the blood treatments, his hair turns iron gray, darker, his cheeks turn ruddy, so it's the blood for cosmetic purposes to make you look younger and younger. Now, that he got from this story she read about of Elizabeth Báthory. There were a couple of pages about her in this book of werewolves written by Sabine Baring Gould, who is most remembered for his rousing hymn, Onward Christian Soldiers. But anyway, he wrote a book on werewolves, too. And in that, he talked about this Elizabeth Báthory, who did these, butchered 650 girls in order to bathe and shower in their blood, because she had this notion that this kept her skin looking white and young, like the skin of the girls. So he took that whole business of the blood for rejuvenation purposes, and connected that all up with the folklore. As you know, in a character in a novel is never an historical personality. Every author worth his or her salt always, you know, makes a composite, a little bit from here, a little bit from there, and that's what happened here. He took various elements from various places and put it all together to create one of the most famous vampires of all time, Count Dracula.
Now, you mentioned that all the folklore in Bram Stoker's book is accurate. Let's talk about that folklore and see what you found out about where it comes from. According to folklore, who becomes a vampire?
Well, let's clarify what we mean in the folklore by a vampire. A vampire is a walking corpse, a resuscitated body. So right away, it is not a ghost. That's important. It's not an apparition. It's not something floating out there and it's going to appear somewhere else or transmigrate or something of that sort. No, it's a corpse. It's reanimated, according to the folklore, by the source of life itself, in the folklore, blood.
And who becomes a vampire?
Well, according to the folklore, it's a little complicated. Someone who's a werewolf is someone, of course, who believes that he or she has become a wolf. A werewolf can become a vampire upon death. Anyone who's led a violent life. In the Christian civilization, children who die unbaptized. Then the seventh son of a seventh son is doomed. In certain parts of Transylvania, someone who's born with blue eyes and red hair is thought, because it's rare, you understand, you know, they're usually dark-haired and have dark eyes, so, you know, the bizarre is often taken to be the fearful thing. So that's the sort. Or, of course, the usual way is if a vampire infects you during life. And that occurs in a very specific way. It's not the way it is in the movies, you know, the bite on the neck and that sort of thing. The vampire must mix his or her blood with yours. You must drink the blood of the vampire so that your blood content changes. And so when you die, you will become united with that vampire in physical immortality, and you must, to prolong your existence, drink the blood of the living.
Is there any pattern in the folklore to who the vampire is likely to use as his prey?
Definite pattern. That's a very important question, too, because vampires never, generally, attack strangers. They always attack members of the immediate family or those with whom they have been intimate in life. Only after they have taken care of the immediate family and friends and lovers and so on, do they branch out. Now, what goes on there is something psychologically very, very profound, I think. If someone you love dies, You don't want them dead, do you? If you really loved them. You're sorry they're gone. You wish they were back with you. That's a very, very old tendency, you know. So there is this immediate wanting to have them back, you see, so that when, as it in their minds anyway, this person comes back from the dead, and the initial reaction is, wow, how great to see you, wonderful, you know, I'm so happy, you're not dead, you're back. Then, though, comes the fear. What is that creature going to be like who has gone through the experience of death? Will it be as human as we are, or will it be something different? And will it, of course, try to lure us into communion with it? And we know what that means. The only way you can join together with someone who has died is to become dead yourself, to go into the land of the dead, and that is the fear element. So that that's very strong in all those folklore stories, this attraction and then fear.
But it would also give you a great reason to be very scared of people within your family or very suspicious of people who you're intimate with.
If they die, look, here's the way it goes. If members of the immediate family, one dies, let's say, and others start dying in rapid succession, then the suspicion is that one of the members is luring the others into the grave. There are a lot of cases like that in American history, of vampire cases, especially in the area around Rhode Island. And they follow that pattern. One member of the family dies, the others start dying rapidly, wonder who's doing it, fear. They dig up the coffins, and they find one undecayed, sign of the vampire. Body's intact. So they have to, you know, do what is done. And what is done is, in Transylvania, the usual way of doing it is drive a stake through the heart or navel during the daylight hours. The idea behind that is to pin the corpse to the earth. Since it's a corpse, you pin it to the earth. It's got to go, stake has to go through the body into the ground, not just the way you see it in the movies. And then as a kind of double insurance, what they do in Transylvania is burn the body. And that is the ultimate weapon, after all. If you burn the body, you've gotten rid of the vampire, because the vampire is a walking corpse. Without the corpse, it's nothing.
There are also, in the movies and in the folklore, ways to repel a vampire with a cross or with garlic.
Yes.
What's the significance of that?
First of all, let's take the oldest weapon is, of course, garlic. And garlic is a medicinal plant. Peasants use it to ward off disease. Anything that wards off disease is thought to have magical qualities and hence can ward off evil, such as werewolves, vampires, devils, and so on. So that's that element. Now, in a Christian civilization, they use it as the cross, because the cross is identified with the force of good and the vampire is identified with the force of evil. In other civilizations, they use other religious symbols. So that's the... It can only ward off the vampire, of course. These symbols are not good to destroy the vampire, just ward him or her off. Vampires, of course, can be male or female. I think that's rather important. They're one of the few night creatures capable of sex.
That's interesting, because you can never, in the movies, well, it depends on the movies. In the Hammer movies, they have sex.
Oh, yeah, and how?
In some of the American movies, they don't. They just, you know, get bitten on the neck.
It's an erotic experience, I would say. I mean, that's, in the novel, it certainly is.
Is that part of oral
sex, after all. I mean, that's what it boils down to. I mean, the vampire is biting, is mixing, you know, having someone else, drink his blood. That's what that's all about.
Well, some people have said that because Bram Stoker wrote the book during the Victorian period, that you couldn't really write about sex. So, you know, in a folklore story like this, you can have ways of describing sex without actually it being
that's
sex.
Correct.
Perversity.
There's incest in the book. There's perversity. But it's all couched in this, you know, for that period, lovely language. But if you take a look at what's going on there, it's bizarre. And the way it is often referred to. I mean, one of the women has the blood of three men running through her finally. And this is brought out to her and thought of as a kind of mystical marriage, that she's married three guys in a way. Their blood is mixed with hers, sort of thing. There's a lot of that sort of stuff in the novel. Part of its appeal, I think.
My guess is Raymond McNally, author of In Search of Dracula and Dracula Was a Woman, and he's been studying vampire folklore for over a decade now. We talked a little bit about sexual imagery in the vampire folklore. There's a lot of religious imagery.
Oh, there certainly is.
In it as well.
Yes, it's a kind of antichrist figure, this vampire. Why? Well, first of all, it promises what all of us who love life want. Eternal life. But of course, eternal life, we don't want that. And if we're going to get old, do we? Who wants that? Right? You want eternal life where you can remain physically young. And that is the promise. A great promise. Physical immortality and to remain young and healthy. So there's that element. And the ceremony itself. You know, what are the two great taboos in modern civilization? One is, we do not eat human blood anymore. And we do not eat human flesh. Those are taboo. They're basically antisocial behavior, right? Because if we were to allow that to go on, somebody's blood has to be drunk. Blood has to be drunk, and some one of us has to give up our bodies to be eaten. However, in several major religions, this is done symbolically. You become one with the divinity by doing what is technically taboo. You drink the blood of the Savior, and you eat his flesh. You commit vampirism and werewolfism. And you join. It is communion. Well, this is a kind of unholy communion. You drink the blood of the vampire. You become one with the vampire. You acquire physical immortality at a great price. But, of course, immortality is usually, there's a price tag attached to it. This one is, you can live in a strange, not normal life, though, because you're a parasite, let's face it, ultimately. You are sucking the blood from the living to continue your existence. I doubt whether many people would find that very attractive way to live. And you're hampered during the daylight hours. You can move, by the way, in the folklore, not unlike the movies, in the daylight hours, but your powers are diminished. So, and you have to continually have someone to watch over your womb tomb, you know. Somebody's got to keep that earth for you around because you've got to return to it. So you're attached to that. You have to take it with you. And so there are all kinds of strictures. So what I think the appeal of the story is, say, oh, wow, to live forever and to be young, wonderful. But then sour grapes. And so it's a consolation.
Let's look at some of the movies that have helped make bring the story to
oh, I think you're right.
to the contemporary public.
It's what made it into a household word was the movie. The movies made the name, and I mean, you know, the novel is one thing.
Well, there's two really especially famous movies: Nosferatu and Dracula, the one that starred Bela Lugosi.
Yes.
Let's look at the Bela Lugosi one first, because that's probably the better known one. He's in the movie a very suave, sophisticated, attractive count.
Right.
How does that compare to the legends? You know,
no, it doesn't, because in the legends now of vampires, the vampire is a resuscitated corpse. So that's what it looks like. Ugly. You know, it's been in the grave. So, you know, it doesn't look handsome or anything of that sort. It's emaciated. It's haggard and so on. Not that way, but that's the demon lover business, that's a very romantic notion, of course, and that's probably why they threw it in like that, made it up like that. Bela Lugosi was, of course, a Hungarian, so he learned a lot of his lines phonetically. He didn't know English very well, so a lot of those deliveries are rather funny. But Transylvania, it reminds me of the twisted battlements of my castle in Transylvania.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Raymond McNally, who has been studying the Dracula legend for many years. He's the author of In Search of Dracula and Dracula Was a Woman, as well as several other books about vampires. You say that contemporary doctors distinguish between two types of vampires.
Yes.
Now, I was actually surprised to find that contemporary doctors
yes.
are interested in vampires or have people who they'd even identify as being vampires.
We're moving away from the field of folklore and into the subject of case study, actually. And medical doctors have a category known as living vampire. It's a regular medical category, not a folklore category. What does it mean? It means there are two types of living vampires. One is someone who has a physiological need for fresh blood. Someone with extremely severe anemia, bad blood, needs fresh, healthy blood, craves it. Second case is someone who has a pathological addiction to blood. Someone who sees in blood some sort of sexual thrill. And there are plenty of cases of that. The woman whose biography is in my book, Dracula Was a Woman, she's definitely classifiable as a living vampire. She's not an undead. She's not back from the grave. But she had this blood fixation. According to the legends, she butchered nearly 650 girls in order to bathe and shower in their blood because she thought the blood made her skin look as young and healthy as that of the young girls. Now, at first sight, a lot of us would say, oh, how sick and macabre. But, you know, in the Snow White story, there's a particularly revealing passage. That's one of the most famous fairy tales all over the world. There are versions in all sorts of different civilizations. And in that, we all know the story, but what some of us may not remember is in the unexpurgated grimmest of the grim stories, the wicked queen wants Snow White dead for a purpose. Just doesn't want her dead. She wants her insides so she can eat them and become like Snow White. You are what you eat, an old principle. You ingest someone beautiful, you become beautiful, that sort of thing. So she has the hunter bring her back what she thinks are the innards of Snow White, and she has her cook it up with salt. It's right there in the story, and she eats it and hopes it will happen. So it's a bizarre notion, but, well, it's just something carried to the extreme. You know, you have to watch out what you ingest, sort of thing, and if you want to acquire the characteristics of someone else, join with them. It's one way. It's antisocial, and of course it's pathological. And there are plenty of cases, contemporary cases of this. We had one just up in Boston, 1981, court case of a young boy who thought he was a vampire. And he was, in the terms of a living vampire. He shot his grandmother 4 times and then sucked the blood out of the wounds. And then he knocked a horse over the head and took the blood and mixed it up with crackers and ate it like people eat cereal. And he killed a cat and drank that blood. So he was into that. So there's a Dr. Robert McCulley at the University of South Carolina who's a psychiatrist who specializes in treating these cases of living vampires.
Have you ever come across a story where you suspected there might be a real vampire in the classical undead sense?
Yes, one. When I was in Transylvania, I was at the foot of Castle Dracula, and I met a woman there her name was Tinka. She's one of the local villagers. And she told me that her father had died. This was 30 years before. She was telling me about something that happened 30 years before when her father died. And he was laid out to rest, and in that part of the world, as in other parts of the world, they keep the corpse in the house for 2-3 days before they put it in the ground. They noticed after 3 days that the skin was still pliable. Rigor mortis had not set in. And the cheeks bore a ruddy complexion. So the blood hadn't calcified. Signs of the vampire, the undead. So she told me she knew what had to be done, but she couldn't do it because, after all, it was her father's body, and she couldn't bring herself to do it. But the villagers went ahead and did it, and they did what is done in all the horror movies. They drove a wooden stake through the corpse, and then as an added insurance, they burned the body.
Are there still places like Transylvania where the legends are circulating and people still live in fear of it?
Oh, yes, definitely. I visited places. With members of the Institute of Folklore, I went up into the mountains with a tape recorder, and we sat down with the peasants, and if you do it correctly, you have to talk about the crops. You know, you can't just walk up to a peasant and say, hey, how about vampires or something? A peasant will lie to you, and peasants are not stupid. It's a wrong assumption on the part of many city people, you know, say, oh, these stupid peasants, they're not stupid. They're very clever oftentimes. You have to get their confidence. You talk about the peaches and the cows and all. And then you start asking them a little bit about, well, what do you know about the history of this place and so on? Have you ever heard of anything like a walking dead, an undead? You know, that's, and then they will open up once they know you're not making fun of them. And the belief is very much alive there.
How did you feel in Transylvania when you went there the first time? And, you know, you didn't know what to expect exactly.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I must say, the Transylvanian, the people there are very hospitable. And they have a strong peasant culture. They wear their costumes. It's a very lovely place to visit. But when I did get to the castle, now here's the problem. I was the first really to connect up all these matters of the castle and Dracula and all that. And so the castle was just in ruins when I got there. It was not a tourist attraction or anything because no one made the connection because of what I just explained. They don't know the connection that there. So I wanted to be the first, you know, into the castle and all that. So I climbed up faster. We had a party of people, including some Romanian archaeologist who was an old man. Anyway, when I got to the top, I did, well, I fell down in a kind of faint, actually, and felt a cold chill. Now, this, part of this can be explained because it's sort of like, you know, when you've been thinking about something for years and years and years and never really, I mean, seriously believing you're ever going to find Castle Dracula, the real thing, and then you do, and you're finally there, then all these experiences often seem to, you know, swell together, as it were, and come together, and you get overwhelmed, and I was. And also I have a problem with acrophobia. At this point, there was just a little metal footbridge, quite old, which you had to walk across in order to get into the castle. So I wasn't about to do that until a Romanian colleague came along and actually held my hand, and as long as I could feel human contact, then I felt all right about it, and once I got in there, I was all right. But for that moment, there was a rush of fear, and I did remember all the horrible and cruel things that had happened there, committed by this fellow. So all those things came together in my mind, I think. So I did feel apprehensive, fear, that sort of thing.
That was Raymond McNally. His books about vampires include In Search of Dracula, A Clutch of Vampires, and Dracula Was a Woman. McNally is a history professor at Boston College. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for today's show was Ron Barron. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce Fresh Air. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.